From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made at McDonald's restaurants, where elderly men gather early in the morning for coffee, where groups of friends play dominoes, where people without homes take a break from the sweltering heat or the frigid cold. The scenes can describe McDonald's dining rooms in any part of the country. But in some communities, the restaurants are more than just a place to grab a bite to eat. As author Chris Arnotti says, they become like town squares. Arnotti had a successful career as a Wall Street trader for nearly two decades, made a lot of money, lived in the best part of Brooklyn. But about 15 years into that trading career, after the 2008 recession, he wanted a change. And each day he'd leave the office and walk through different parts of New York, exploring places people told him not to go, communities stigmatized by poverty or drugs or sex work or all of them. He ended up spending a lot of time in Hunts Point, part of the Bronx. And there he met a woman named Takesha, a prostitute who had been pushed into the work by her mother's pimp at the age of 12. Also Takesha's husband, Steve, a former drug user who was now clean. Arnotti spent nearly every day with them, helping them get the little things they needed, driving them to places like the hospital or motels, also to McDonald's, where people just like them found refuge from the streets and from the difficult lives they lived. Arnotti found similar situations as he drove nearly 150,000 miles across the country to the most impoverished neighborhoods, the places where political leaders of all parties tend to forget. Portsmouth, Ohio, Gary, Indiana. He saw vulnerable populations doing the best they could after their communities were devastated by deindustrialization, by structural racism, and more. Arnotti chronicled his journey and shared candid portraits of what he calls back row America in his remarkable book called Dignity. It's a look at struggle, at self-respect, and about the need for human connection in communities that have often been forgotten. It's also a book that asks readers to examine their own advantages and the way we judge others. Now, before the pandemic, we intended to speak with him about his work, and now it feels even more urgent. In this hour, we welcome Chris Arnotti to talk about what he learned and the struggles in these communities that have been made even more acute by the pandemic. Chris, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Well, and let me just kind of start by asking you once again, because you've been on the program once before, but remind listeners who don't fully know your story, what happened in sort of your own brain that made you think, you know, you're sort of done with Wall Street and you wanted to do all the things people said you shouldn't do?
Yeah, I wish I had a really succinct answer for that. I struggle to put it into one sentence beyond just feeling a bit like the career I had and the life I was living was bubbled and kind of shallow, and that I think the financial crisis in particular really brought that to the forefront. And I had always found relaxation by taking these immensely long walks through New York City, you know, 20 miles or so. And the nature of those walks shifted as I became more and more frustrated with my career in banking and the whole banking industry. And I used them more to talk to people, not just to, visit different places. It became a sort of a different learning experience. And during that process, as that evolved, it took on a personal side, which was me learning about a different way of learning through talking to people as opposed to actually just looking at numbers or reading books. But also it took on a political side, which I was very frustrated by the inequality I was seeing and how that inequality could be so misunderstood in what I considered to be the mainstream media or most of the places I was getting my information from at the time.
Mm-hmm. I want to let our listeners know the book is called Dignity. It is available now. And, we try to bring in authors who do the kind of work that we think you would find valuable. I would put this on the top of any list if you haven't already picked it up. I think it's one of the most important books written maybe in the last decade, and just a remarkable piece of work that allows us to see communities, to get to know real human stories, and to ask questions about ourselves. And so let me ask you about yourself. What did you find changing most about yourself when you would take those walks and when you would have those conversations and when you would learn what you were learning, Chris?
At one level, I was learning about my own privilege. Now, I come from the political left, and I've been what I considered a thoughtful person when it comes to inequality all my life. And yet I realized that over the course of my career, which had gone through getting a PhD and then ended up in Wall Street, I had really removed myself from the people I thought I was advocating for the people I thought I was helping, or for the people I thought I understood. And it just was this real realization that I really didn't understand the country that I was I was helping to make decisions on. And I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the perspective of people who, you know, were the bulk of the country. So I think there was a realization that of my own kind of, to use a cliche, bubbled, you know, I was a bubbled elite. But in additionally, there was also just the realization, kind of a deeper realization that at a more philosophical level, but the whole idea, the whole way I looked at the world, the whole framework I had for judging kind of what is true was just a very narrow, a quantitative approach. I was a mathematician. I looked at things at numbers, and I looked at spreadsheets, and that there was a whole different way of learning and a whole different value system that I had generally dismissed, which was one that was based more on intuition, more based on experience, and one more based on faith. And so, you know, in kind of a bumper sticker at a more kind of where the rubber hits the road, I went into this project. I mean, it was never really a project, but I went into this, I used to say I was a vegetarian atheist, and I came out of it someone who eats at McDonald's and goes to church.
I'm not laughing to sort of minimize. I mean, it's a remarkable transformation for someone from Wall Street.
I mean, it is funny though. I can laugh at it.
Okay. Well, no, you can laugh at a lot more than I have. You have walked the walk on this, and to the extent that there is, you know, there has been any criticism of the book, occasionally you hear the kind of criticism that, well, here is this wealthy white guy who's going into communities, which, by the way, are not all communities of color, not at all. Though, I mean, it is a wide range of communities across the country that have been devastated by different economic forces. And it's not always the same state to state, or even sort of part of the state to a part of the state. But to the extent that there's been criticism, it sounds like this. Well, here's this wealthy white guy going into these communities, taking pictures, writing stories. Now he writes a book and he wants to make money. And really what he's exploiting and not helping. And I know you've heard that, but what is your response to that?
Usually the form it takes is poverty porn. And I say, well, you know, I wish we have enough luxury porn, so why not a little bit of poverty porn? But I feel like, you know, I have to let the work stand on its own. I ask the people just to read the book, and you know, this was not a career choice to make more money by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I gave up a high-paying job to make no money. And it was also, I would just simply say, about dedication. You know, I spent 8 years doing this. And I think there are similar projects out there that I think can be done very badly. Someone goes into a neighborhood, gets what they want, and leaves. I spent 4 years in the Bronx. I spent, often a month in many of these towns I visited. And so I read the book. And if it still feels that way afterwards, there's nothing I can really do about that. I'm always going to be an outsider given the nature of the project. And when you have to, as a person who comes in with this knowledge, you have to know that, and you have to use that, be aware of that when you and how you operate and how you function in these neighborhoods. You know, it's one thing to go in and, you know, demand to see the mayor and demand to see all the bigwigs. It's another to go in and sit quietly in, you know, a booth at McDonald's for 3 weeks and just let people talk to you. And one, I think, is a very, you know, the latter is which I did, is I think is a form of trying to learn instead of trying to lecture. You know, don't go in and lecture people. Go in and listen to people. And no matter who you are, if you go in and listen to people, I think you can solve a lot of the problems about privilege.
I don't want to get too tied up in politics, but politics matters. It impacts people. And I want to ask you a little bit about how your own views on that have changed, because as you said, you came from the political left. But as you traveled the country and spent the time that you did, what did you find yourself becoming convinced that Democrats had failed in doing?
They left the working class behind. I emerge out of a Democratic Party where the meetings for the local county level, growing up in the 70s in the South, the meetings for the Democratic club were in my parents' house. And, you know, it was a collection of working class people, very diverse, because we're in the South, and if you're a Democrat in the South, they're going to be a pretty diverse coalition. But everybody was, you know, there were very few people with high degrees of education. And that wasn't, I don't say that, that's a positive in my mind. And now I look at the Democratic Party, at least the part of the party that I think really controls the platform and controls the money in the power, and it's not very much different than the Wall Street I left behind. And so it no longer really reflects the working class to the degree it used to, and that's a problem. And that was a slow realization that I didn't particularly want to come to. I support Democrats, and I still support Democrats. But it's very frustrating to me to see the party be in my mind so out of touch with the voters it claims to advocate for. And again, I don't think that's a cynical thing. I think it comes from a place of good intentions. It's not that people want to be out of touch. It's not that people want to. It's just that I think over time, the party has shifted to be more and more about the party of the highly educated.
And so there's a section in the book, a photo section just called Coping. And what I was struck in working through these photographs in the section called Coping, I was struck that probably a significant percentage of well-educated, left-leaning people would think about the images represent, you know, what was being represented in each image and maybe be prone to sneering at it. And by the way, I always want to be clear in conversations like this. I'm not excluding myself here. And I'm not even describing my own politics, but just my own, you know, I'm not perfect. We've all sort of judged others. But in the section of Coping, there's NASCAR, there's drug use, there's prayer groups and prayer circles and services and worship. There's McDonald's, you know, the kinds of things. There's people praying at McDonald's. You know, there's prostitution. That section on Coping alone has every photograph is the kind of photograph that people might find themselves sneering at, not asking why. And I would love for you to sort of relate what you hope lands with your readers when they kind of work through those kind of images, Chris.
Right. I think for the people from the left, I mean, there's, you know, I also have a lot of messages I would like the people on the right to take home, but for the people on the left, it's that, you know, a lot of the things we kind of dismiss or forget or look down on as lesser are parts of the working class. It's you know, we're going to be the party of the working class, and we're going to be the champion of people who have less than us. That should include people who have less education than us, and that should include how, you know, I use a McDonald's test as you talked about in the intro. One of the places I spent a lot of time in is McDonald's, because they are community centers in these towns, and I think we in the center, and I say this as this is as much an indictment on the right, if not more of an indictment on the right, is we've created a political environment that's not conducive to community health, to local community health. So we've created this society that's very much about the transactional, very much about money, and very much about profits. And it's very hard for community to thrive in this situation. And so, you know, McDonald's is a perfect example. McDonald's and Walmart have sprung up everywhere, and they've destroyed a lot of local community, and yet, you know, this is all these people have. This is all a lot of communities have, and they have to form community in them. And so if I wanted to find, if I want to, and, you know, I think a lot of the people on the left in particular look down at McDonald's as this awful, you know, place for unhealthy food. But McDonald's serves an essential role in these communities by default now, which is it's a community center. It's where people can go to get inexpensive food and spend a few minutes escaping from the cold or the heat and also not be judged. And I think, you know, when I walk into a neighborhood, if I walk into a new town and I want to see the immigrants, I want to meet immigrants and I want to talk to them, or I want to meet, go to a place where I can meet a very diverse group of working class people, I go to the Walmart or I go to McDonald's. These are places where the lived reality is, you know, is much more diverse, and it's a core part of who the working class is. And I think people on the left look down on that to some degree, you know, as kind of somehow beneath them to eat at a McDonald's.
Well, let's talk a little bit about just the title of the book, and I think the struggle that maybe sometimes people who are policymakers, sometimes people in media have in allowing others to have values and to derive dignity in different ways than we would. You know, and I think Walmart and McDonald's are good examples. I mean, people often sort of operate in the policy sphere and, well, if you just put more money in people's hands, they'd stop going there. You know, they would stop doing this. They would live the way I live. You know, they would want the same things that I would want. How seductive is it to assume, especially for the educated class, which Chris calls, by the way, for listeners, the front row kids, the highly educated, how seductive is it to think that what you want as an educated person is what everybody would want if they just were smart enough or wealthy enough to have?
I don't think it's – I think that's very true, but I think it's even worse than that. I think we demand it. We demand it for success. I think, you know, I just got finished reading a book that's similar to my book in scope. It's called Tightrope by Nick Kristof in New York Times. And where I disagree a lot with his book is he comes in and sees these communities and says, oh, this is really bad. We have to get them educated. We have to get them off to college like I went off to college, which is, in my mind, a very colonial attitude, which is we come in and say, you know, you in the African-American community, in the black community, there's this term called acting white. You have to act white to be successful. You have to act white to navigate in the business community and in the legal community. I would expand that to say that's a very true concept. I would expand to say you have to act front row. You have to act educated. And that includes having, you know, not just having a resume. It includes having certain views and certain ideological and certain tastes. And if you don't have that, you're going to be basically continue to be on the outside. I would rather us look at and I include myself in there, these communities and say, you know, I don't want to preach to them and tell them what they need to do. I want to listen to them and find out what we can do to change the culture, to change the society, so that we're more inclusive and we're more understanding of different viewpoints of life. You know, so I think it at its worst, you know, there's this idea that people vote against their self-interest, which is, I find, in a very an extremely arrogant view that I know what someone wants better than they know what they want. And I think that framework is very, again, it's an intellectual colonialism to say, you know, you need to do this to be successful. You have to follow you have to give up your faith. You have to give up your family. You have to give up your community. You have to value, you have to be part of the resume arms race. Get out there, go to, you know, start getting into honors programs, start doing all those things and do the usual thing that we all do. So many of us who are successful and well-educated do. And I think that, and again, I don't think, and I want to emphasize this to the listeners because I know a lot of them are that type of person as I am. I don't think we're badly intended. I don't think the front row has bad intentions. I think it comes at it with very, very good intentions. It really does think it's helping. And my concern is I think in many cases we're doing more damage than help.
Talking to Chris Arnotti, who is the author of the book Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. And the book is out now, I would put it on any reading list to pick up and try to understand what has really entrenched in among the divisions in this country, not just politically, but just the way we've sort of drawn up the lines of society and the way we have such little understanding. You know, one thing that people, I think, probably asked you all the time, and we talked about this last time you were on, you know, people can't believe that you spend all this time in what they would call drug houses or different communities and never felt unsafe, never felt threatened, or rarely ever felt that way because of the stereotypes. Well, if you go into this neighborhood, you know, I had a member of the New York State Assembly on this program who told me he couldn't go to his old Rochester neighborhood unless he had an armored car. I mean, it's not far from where I live. And I offered to go there with him. And he joked that, you know, you'd need bulletproof glass. It was the mentality that becomes really deeply embedded over time. How much surprise do people have that you actually can as long as you're probably a respectful person, you can move in all kinds of different circles against the stereotypes that you would be unsafe?
Right. I think this is, going back to your earlier question, I would say this is the one case where being a white guy helps. I mean, really, really helps. Explicit meaning. I think females would have a lot of different issues to face, and I certainly think African American
being a white guy, I got you.
But look, I mean, you know, I think one of my biggest frustrations is I think a lot of people, and I include politicians and people in the media, don't do what I did because of fear. They don't want to go. And I had many times, you know, reporters would come with me and they would ask me multiple times, is it going to be safe? And I'm like, yes, it's going to be safe. You know, just use your wits about you. When I was there on your show last, I did spend some time in, quote, the unsafe neighborhoods of your town, and it was fine. You know, everybody was nice to me. I got a lot of pictures from it, a lot of conversations. And, you know, I think I'll use my old math. I'll put on my old math hat and say, look, you know, if a neighborhood's really, really safe, 99% of the people are playing by the rules, right? 1% of the people are engaged in crime. If it's not safe, that number is still 94%, 95%, you know, 90%. The overwhelming majority of people are good people who are just trying to get by, and they are as frustrated with the criminal activity in their neighborhood and the stigma that comes attached to that as anybody. And so they're more than willing to be part of, to go out of their way to prove to you, to show you that this neighborhood is unfairly stigmatized. I wouldn't encourage people to go into a crack house like I did at 2 a.m. But I would say that I think our concepts about what is dangerous are a little bit overhyped, and the reality is a lot more nuanced, not surprisingly.
Sure, and I know, as you mentioned, your message is for readers from all backgrounds. It's not just the political left. If you were summarizing what you really hope people who come from the political right who pick up your book find, what do you hope they find?
Oh, I mean they may understand the lived reality of the working class better, but they don't have their interests at heart. The predatory capitalism that they've embraced over the last since I've been alive has done immense damage to these communities. Free trade, destruction of labor unions, all this has set the scene for so much of what's going on. The second message would be quite simply, the working class is not just whites. It's Hispanics, it's Latinos, it's blacks. If you want to be the party of the working class, like you claim to want to be the party of the working class, you need to put your time in non-white neighborhoods.
And so when it comes to dealing with things like the pandemic, you know, there was all kinds of debate about the best way to help people immediately. And Congress ends up settling on what is now $600 to $700 billion for small business loans, in sort of a Hunger Games style, competing, getting the applications in on time, and you know the Los Angeles Lakers get one of those small business grants, and you know, and then there's a one-time $1,200 check that goes out. I'm curious to know if you were in the policy room and they said, you know what, we should have Chris Arnotti design this thing to really help people. Where would your focus have been?
I believe, I forget her exact name, there's a Democratic lawmaker. I believe she's from Michigan. I think she was one of the squad. Presley is her last name. I forget which one of the squad.
Oh, Ayanna Presley is from, I think she's from the Northeast. I think Rashida Tlaib is from Michigan. But
I forget which one of the squad came out with it. Basically, it was the one I would endorse, which was a lot of people came out with similar ones, which was, I think, $2,000 a month. For everybody until we get a green light. I would just give people cash. I'm a big believer in low bureaucracy. Bureaucracy hurts the working class and the poor more than does anybody. Means testing hurts them. Just give everybody. I don't care if you're a billionaire or if you are homeless. Everybody deserves $2,000 a month. $500 for kids, $2,000 per adult, and until this ends. And I think that would have gone a long way to getting rid of all the complicated things they ultimately did. That basically is trying to do the same thing, but for some reason has to be 9 different programs over 4 different agencies. I'm all believe in simplicity. Just hand people cash. If some people are going to abuse it, that's just the cost of saving the economy. People always abuse every system. I worked in Wall Street. I watched rich people abuse every system legally. And so I don't got much time for people saying some poor people are going to abuse it. So what?
I certainly hear that. But when you say that, heavy levels of bureaucracy or layers of bureaucracy hurt the working class and people in poverty the most, is it because just accessing the ostensible help becomes more difficult and complicated?
Yeah, it's a barrier to entry. It's a barrier. I've spent so much of my time, when I do something I didn't write much about in the book, but something that I did a lot of over the course of 8 years was, I would spend about 4 hours a night in McDonald's in poor neighborhoods. I'd sit there typing up my notes, eating my ice cream cone. And then by the end of the time, my time in any of these towns, I would have a bunch of people who would be sitting with me or talking to me or coming up to chat with me or just hanging out with me. And inevitably, when I asked how to help them, they would be using my computer to help them navigate through all the myriad of, I became an ad hoc social, ad hoc social worker, helping people navigate through, what happens if you have no ID? How do you get your welfare? How do you get your SNAP recipients? And going to the Social Security officer in these places is just a very demeaning experience that feels like you're walking through a labyrinth of a soulless institution. And so I'm all for streamlining the process and removing the means testing so people can really there's a colonial attitude of and you see this with SNAP recipients.
Oh yeah, what are they buying with this money? Yeah. Right.
Yes, exactly. Oh look, they're buying sugary drinks. They're buying TV dinners. That's not healthy. Well, they don't have a lot of time either. I'm a firm believer in just give people money and let them do with it what they want, and I trust that they'll do what in aggregate they'll do the right thing.
Talking to Chris Arnotti, the author of the book Dignity, that I hope everyone picks up and really spends some time, just as I have, thinking about the themes of the book and how it reflects some of our own biases and judgments. I am certainly not immune, and I am grateful for his work. We have to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to get some of your phone calls. And then I want to talk a little bit more with Chris about how he views the pandemic and who is most vulnerable and sort of the different waves of a pandemic where, the virus hits and then who is able to sort of retreat, who is not, who is left vulnerable, and what does society do about that? He's our guest for the hour, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the president of Brown University wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying that it is vital that colleges and higher ed go back to school in the fall, in the classrooms, on campus, in dorms, welcoming students in person. Critics have said that makes it look more like a business proposition than anything else. We're going to have a conversation about where higher ed can expect to go during the pandemic. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I just real briefly want to let listeners know that this is the one day in May that we are asking you to really think hard about supporting public radio. And I am not really going to try to sugarcoat this. I mean, the pandemic's been rough for everybody for obvious reasons. Well, for most, for obvious reasons. And that's true at NPR. That's true at member stations like ours. What we don't want to be is in a position of cutting journalists and cutting newsrooms. And realistically, that could happen. That could happen anywhere. And I mean, it is happening in a lot of places. And so this is not at all a threat. This is just the reality of the situation we're facing. We have a phenomenal community that has stepped up to support us here in Rochester. And to support a two-hour talk show that is regional, there's not a whole lot of that in the country anymore. And you support that when you call 454-6300. We ask you to do that, 454-6300. There are people who are stepping up today to make sure any contribution is doubled. Cricket and Frank Llewellyn, Ann Stevens and Bill Shattuck, Joel and Dottie Elias, Nanette Noken, Karen Wolf, thank you, all of you, because everybody who calls 454-6300 will have any contribution doubled. And anything matters to us. Now, if you're someone in a position where you're out of work or you're really struggling, I'm not necessarily talking to you. We want to sort of advocate for you and support you and be there for you and be a journalistic voice that shines light. We've done a lot on small business owners and working class and people out of work and people trying to navigate the kind of things that Chris Arnotti's talking about, this Byzantine system of either unemployment insurance or otherwise ostensible forms of help. But we want to be a voice for the community. Please call 454-6300 if you can and if you feel comfortable to do it. 454-6300 and online at WXXINews.org. Hit the give button. And thank you very much. Let me get to some of your phone calls here. This is Laura in Rochester first. Go ahead, Laura.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chris Arnetti, for another very necessary book. I live in the South Wedge quadrant of the city of Rochester. And I live on a very narrow one-way street. It's quite dismal. It's not tree-lined. It's trash-lined. And I do my part to pick it up. Our houses go right to the street. We have no driveways. We have no garages. And I live in a very small bungalow that I've owned for 25 years. I'm still paying a mortgage. And again, for the third time in 8 years, our mayor, lovely Warren, has raised the value of these properties, which AKA raises our property taxes in order to get taxes. And it's, you know, whether it's a severe virus or not, this has created such a difficult hardship on myself and other residents. The people who live on my street are generally retired. They collect, possibly they're getting subsidized funding. There's no children. And I went through the whole process of an in-person review when this came up, and the reviewer took all my documentation and pictures and so on that I revealed to her about my own home, which was built in 1900. It's an 800-square bungalow, very tiny yard, and it's pretty much in the condition of 1900. And she got it. You know, she made recommendations not to raise my property value so high. But when it went to the assessor, they shot it down. And then I did an appeal. And because of the virus, it was done over the phone. And it was four people against me. They would not let me finish a sentence. They did not see any documentation that I had. And an assessor came on the phone and said, I deny your appeal. We're raising it to the property value we think it is, like it or not. And now it is incredibly devastating. And what is so absurd about this is that my property insurance went up for the first time in so many years, on top of everything. So I called them, and they said to me, Lori, your property is not worth this much. We have to, because it was built in 1900, so much of it is still existing. We fear you're going to have, even though I never made a claim, we fear things down the road may happen, so we have to raise your insurance this significant amount. So this is what's happening in the city of Rochester. There's little quadrants in the city that the young, quite frankly, white people want to move to because it's kind of hip and trendy, even though all those hip and trendy stores have folded and closed. And, you know, you can walk to 7 bars, but you still have to take a bus or drive out of the area to get to a grocery store. But because it's kind of trendy, this mayor, and actually Mayor Richards started it before her, has, you know, used this area to raise the taxes and get money from, when so many of us are very low income, myself included. So it's happening right here in this little city of Rochester, in different places where the mayor feels she can pick and get her money from. And some people say, well, gosh, if my property's worth this much, I can turn around and sell it and, you know, maybe relocate or something. But so many of us are suffering from it because that's not our intentions, such as myself. I want to remain in my home, quite frankly, until I pass away. And she has, again, for the third time, 012, 015, 020 has now, no one even came down the street. No one even came down the street, Mr. Chris or Evan. No one even looked. She just did it by virtue of somebody's property 4 streets down, because I'm on the other side of the tracks, as they say. She did it by virtue of somebody's 4 properties down, very close to Highland Park.
Laura, let me just kind of jump in and ask Chris. You know, she's describing, well, first of all, a lot of pain there, and I'm trying to hear you, Laura, and I'm
thank you,
and I'm sorry. She's also describing, you know, the kinds of ways that American cities are dividing, and there's gentrification in certain places, and then there's, I mean, that's probably something that you saw in a lot of different American cities, Chris.
Yeah, and again, not to diminish her story, but I just want her to know that I've heard variations of her story from so many different people, and, you know, that she's not alone, and by any stretch, for having feeling like everybody, you know, she's getting it from every direction, from elected officials, from the bureaucracy, from the people moving in. And I think that's a common feeling of so many people I met, which is that, you know, it's, and again, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but almost a helplessness, a feeling like nobody's out there to look out for me. You know, one of the things that, you know, the gentrification issue is a double-edged sword, because, you know, it's all fine and dandy if the residents have a stake in their neighborhood as it becomes a nicer neighborhood, so to speak, and so they can benefit in the change in the neighborhood. But so often, because the poor the back row doesn't have an equity stake or doesn't have the ability to stay in, or are generally pushed out. And you see that in New York City, and I saw that over my as neighborhoods changed. You know, the front row kind of wanted their neighborhood back because it was their new play. It was their new plaything, and so, you know, they push. You know, and so you see at its most hypocritical level, you see, you know, well-educated leftists coming in and basically pushing out minorities and working class people because they want the neighborhood, because they find the neighborhood to be hip. And that's a problem. And I see that here. You know, I live in upstate New York. I see that here. My home is surrounded by five or six homes that are all people who are working class. I'm the newcomer, and the property taxes are going up, and I feel bad for them because they don't have the steady income that's going to be necessary to stay in the place that's honestly their neighborhood and not mine. So it's a real problem. I will say that it's probably the better problem to have than what I see in other neighborhoods where, and you see that in a lot of Rochester, as you know, that where the factories left and the homes are closing up, like you have in lots of Buffalo, for instance. At my most polemic, I kind of say the wealthy are over time change their whims about where they want to live, and when they want it, they just take it and they push people out.
Some more listener feedback. Ryan just wants to know, does your guest today, Chris, consider himself part of the Yang Gang, considering his stance on UBI?
I like Andrew. I am not a huge fan of UBI, only because I'm one of those people that actually does believe, I'm open to criticism about it. I do believe that work does provide dignity, and I think most everybody I've ever met has wanted a job more than cash handouts. But I'm all cool with I'm a big believer in UBI in the sense that I do believe that the social safety net should be replaced with cash handouts as opposed to the complex array of systems we have now.
And to be clear to the listener, you are a fan of UBI $2,000 per month during the pandemic.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely.
The next guest on the line is a member of the New York State Assembly, Mark Johns. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, Evan and Chris. Just tuned in a while ago. I heard you talking about something, as you know, or maybe your guest doesn't. I'm a Republican. But, I told my father, because my parents are both Democrat, and they were Depression-era Democrats. And he goes, well, why'd you sign up to be a Republican? I said, well, it's because I'm a conservative. I believe in a balanced budget. He goes, well, so do I, but I'm not a Republican. So, the party, what I heard you saying, kind of drifted. And the Republican Party doesn't really hold out a lot of hope to the working class, especially the working poor. But what really piqued my interest in politics was back in the 90s, and I heard you mention this, the World Trade Deal, the World Trade Organization. That was a race to the bottom. And everybody understood that. I was very proud of Nancy Pelosi back then because she fought that thing tooth and nail. Nobody knew who she was back in 1994. And a lot of others did as well. Ross Perot, Nancy Pelosi, Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, Jesse Jackson. And they all stood together and said, this is crazy. And now, with the pandemic, we see that sending all the manufacturing outside this country is crazy, and it's a race to the bottom. So, you know what? I think both parties have failed us. Joe Biden promoted this stuff. The Clintons promoted it. Bill Clinton signed it into law. And you make people more dependent on government handouts when you take away the opportunity for a good-paying job.
Yeah, one of the things that and I hope you get a chance to look at my book. I think you'll find. I think neither political party is particularly happy with my book. But I would say that where I agree, I don't put policy solutions in my book because I try to make it a little bit more timeless than that. But I believe that free trade and outsourcing jobs has absolutely crushed the United States, and it was an awful. It's also a good way to remind ourselves, at least I try to use it as a way to remind ourselves that, the educated elite, the smart people, the eggheads, as I used to call them when I was a kid, which I'm one of, often get it wrong. And so, you know, if you, as you know, in the 90s and 80s, if you were against free trade, if you were against the open, you know, outsourcing jobs, you were considered crazy. You know, it was so obvious to everybody who had a PhD in economics that free trade was going to help the world, help the United States. And that it was sold as that. And the problem is it hasn't. It's completely devastated communities. And the losses are not just, you know, 3% job loss in Rochester or 10% job loss in Buffalo or 20% job loss in, you know, Prestonburg, Ohio. There are communities that are churches gone, bowling leagues collapsing, families falling apart, drugs coming in, and also angry politics coming in, because there's a way to cope with the frustration. One of those is turning to populism in politics. So I'm very much with you that I think that the various trade deals that have been enacted, especially those in the 90s, have been very damaging to the U.S., especially giving China most favored nation trading status. That's been a very bad deal. On Wall Street, we called it labor arbitrage, which is a fancy word for saying you can make more profits by finding the most desperate workers in whatever country has the lowest regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Assemblyman. Before I lose the hour with Chris, you have been very vocal about your concerns during a pandemic about maybe looking past the initial wave of infections when, you know, very few people were ready for it, and then asking who gets to shelter in place, who has the space to be quote-unquote safe or insulated from it. And there was an interesting exchange in which the writer Andrew Sullivan, who I've read for many years, he kind of went after some of the early reporting out of Chicago, Milwaukee, focusing on race data. And he said, oh, so the woke scolds are going to be out telling us, you know, we've got to care about the race data even in a pandemic. You had some harsh words, and he actually backed off some of his remarks there after critics like you came out and said that's not necessarily what this is about. What should we be looking at here?
I mean, look, the shelter in place is place covers a lot of ground. place is, you know, when a lot of people put the policy together and talk about it, place is a nice home you can work from in your office, and plenty, you know, plenty of money to go out and buy some deep freezers and enough storage to order from, you know, 50-pound bags of flour from Amazon and a nice yard you can run around in. Place also is, you know, for a lot of my homeless friends, they have no place. It's a shelter. It's a shelter they share with 40 other people. Or it's a trailer park, you know, where you have four generations or three generations and friends sharing a place with one bathroom. It's a third floor walk up, fourth floor walk up in the Bronx with, you know, again, eight people sharing one bathroom. So and crappy Wi-Fi. So I think this idea that, you know, I think we need to understand that sheltering in place is a lot harder for some people than it is for others, and to factor that into the policy we construct. And to also, you know, recognize that the fact that this is disproportionately killing minorities is not some college campus woke kids pointing out some intersectionality. It's just the hard reality that is really depressing. And I think one of the things this pandemic I used to be a particle physicist, and you use particle accelerators to expose the truth, the inner workings of things. And I think this pandemic is a bit like that. It's exposing a lot of ugly truths that we kind of don't want to look at. And one of those things is being poor is much more deadly than being wealthy. And so minorities who are disproportionately poor are suffering here because they don't have the space to, they don't have the resources to quarantine, and they're, quote, they have to go to work, they have to be exposed, and they don't have the healthcare system that will provide them the necessary resources once they get sick. And, you know, being poor is unhealthy. It's unfortunate. It's an ugly reality. And this pandemic, this COVID seems to prey on the unhealthy. It's much more fatal for people unhealthy. Yeah. So it's really, really bad to the working class.
So in our last 90 seconds then, let's look forward in some marginally hopeful way and say, if we've learned the lessons not only from this pandemic, but also the themes of the book of a book like Dignity, what can we rebuild in a different way going forward, Chris?
I don't need to necessarily tell you, because, and you and your listeners know this, because you know, your locally produced show, localism, it's about knowing your, you know, the focusing on your community, focusing on building a healthy community, and recognizing that people need a healthy community. It's good for their mental and physical health to have functioning community, not just making a lot of money, but having church groups and bowling leagues and basketball games that bond people together and make them feel a part of something that's functional.
And maybe making things again a little bit more?
Oh, you know, yes. Rochester used to make a lot of things that shouldn't. You need to make more. Buffalo, your whole area used to make a lot more than it does now, and it needs to make more.
Are you optimistic that this country can make these changes?
You know, I think the pandemic is going to accelerate the recognition that we need to make things again. The pandemic is awful. It's an awful thing. But if that comes out of it, you know, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny silver lining and an awful, awful, awful tragedy.
Thank you. And I'll say it again. I'm grateful for your work on this theme that you've been doing for years now, and for this book, Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. The book is available now. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Arnotti, our guest, and the book, I think, will probably move you in different ways. Thanks to the whole team today. Want to remind you, this is a day that we're asking the community to celebrate and support that localism that Chris is talking about. Lifting up what we do here, you can call 454-6300 and make a pledge of support, making sure that public radio is going to be here like a rock no matter what comes this year, next year, beyond. 454-6300, please do that and do it today, and we are so grateful. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.